Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, bananas as business opportunity, Ukraine as economic basket case, and nutrition labels as an exercise in graphic design. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 10th of March, this is a podcast for that date. As you know, because you're listening, it's great to have you with us. The diplomatic to and fro over Ukraine and Crimea continue. Spokespeople for Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov traded statements throughout the day today. The next actual event on the program is this coming Sunday, the hastily called referendum in Crimea on whether to stay or to go. But whichever way that winds up, Ukraine's problems are far more than just political. Here's Marketplace's Sarah Gardner to get us going today.
So just how bad off is the Ukrainian economy?
The Ukraine has the worst record over the last 20 years of any industrialized economy in the world.
Robert Shapiro, chairman of the economic advisory firm Sonicon, says since departing the Soviet Union, Ukraine's economy has shrunk 30%. It's got one of the biggest underground economies in the world. Its credit rating is worse than Greece. And there's debt, lots of it, says Stanford University political scientist Catherine Stoner.
It owes $13 billion this year, $16 billion estimated at the end of 2015. It only has $12 billion left in hard currency reserves, and Ukraine really does not have the money to pay.
Anders Osland served as an economic advisor to Ukraine in the mid-90s. He says the country has depended on agriculture, steel, and space rocketry, but bad leadership and corruption have jeopardized growth.
President Viktor Yanukovych had one aim for his economic policy, enriching himself as much as possible together with his family, and he didn't care much about the rest.
Which scared off foreign investment. Now, Ukraine says it needs at least $35 billion to fix the mess it's in, and that's just the short term. Stanford's Catherine Stoner says any loans that Ukraine gets from the International Monetary Fund will come with a price.
They're going to have to suck up some harsh macroeconomic reform and get far more fiscally responsible.
Like raising home heating prices, which right now are heavily subsidized. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If you want to know more about Ukraine and Russia and our role over there, you can check out our special report, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Global Economy. With apologies to Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove, it's at marketplace.org. All right, moving on. Painful though it was, last week we were obliged to tell you about the coming end of bananas. Not today, not tomorrow, but someday, and for the rest of our lives, a tropical disease for which there is no treatment is going to wipe out bananas as we know them. Banana apocalypse, we called it. But apparently Chiquita is none too worried. It's going to merge with the Irish company Fife's to create the world's biggest purveyor of bananas and, fun fact, the world's number three distributor of pineapples and melons, too. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
The advantage of a merger here is simple. Bigger is better. The new company expects to ship about $4.6 billion worth of bananas a year. Edward Evans is at the Center for Tropical Agriculture at the University of Florida. He says the two companies can easily streamline their operations.
There is a lot of duplication that they can now cut out.
In other words, this isn't like Apple and Microsoft trying to merge and figuring out how all their tech works together. These companies put bananas on boats. They say they expect to see about $40 million in savings by the end of 2016. Evans says he expects the new company will get another benefit from this move, more negotiating power with customers. As supermarket chains have consolidated, they've gained the upper hand.
And so they were able, to some extent, to say, well, you know, I mean, we're going to pay you less for the bananas, right?
The new entity, Chiquita Fife's, will be based in Ireland, and there are savings there, too. Taxes are lower. Brent Hundley is an analyst with BB&T Capital Markets. He follows the fresh fruit industry. He thinks Chiquita Fife's will also be in a better position to negotiate price when it buys bananas. And that's important because what the companies own are a lot of expensive ships.
And they need to fill those ships with fruit. And so they are somewhat at the mercy of these countries that supply this fruit. Those countries are asking more for their bananas. And so these companies are having to pay up for that fruit.
Hundley says he thinks the savings the companies are projecting are lowball estimates. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Speaking of low ball, see also Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of weeks ago, the Food and Drug Administration and First Lady Michelle Obama announced changes to what is officially called the Nutrition Facts label. That box on the back is something like 700,000 products that tells you how good or how bad something is for you. It is, I think it's fair to say, iconic, that box. Berkey Belzer is the graphic designer who did the original one 20-some-odd years ago. Mr. Belzer, it's good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kai. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you very much. It's kind of you to say. And I'm a fan of the nutrition labels, by the way, which is why we're talking. What ran through your mind when you first heard that they were going to redo this label?
Ooh. Well, I was scared about what the results might be.
Yeah.
I have a lot of affection, obviously, for the original design. But one hopes for the best.
Okay. So let's cut to the chase. What do you think of it?
It's as if my dog died and I got a new puppy I like, but not as much as I loved old Spot.
Yeah, there you go. I get that.
Yeah.
Is it true that you wound up having to do the original nutrition label pro bono because Congress hadn't allocated the money for the informatics on this thing?
Yeah, that's right. They allocated appropriated funds to revisit the science of the label, but it never occurred to them that it ought to be designed. So we did the job pro bono.
Well, so let me ask you about a couple of design points just on the nutrition level, since that's the one we're talking about. No punctuation, which I hadn't noticed, honestly, until I started reading material for this interview. There's not a comma, there's not a semicolon, there's not a period on that whole thing, the one you designed.
That's right. What we discovered is that there are, well, first of all, we're designing for all Americans, not just one, you know, an educated American with a college education. And we discovered that punctuation. We even tried, by the way, charts and graphs, sliding bars, everything. We discovered that all of that slows down a halting reader or a reader where English is their second language or an aging reader, any of that stuff all made a difference. So we removed everything that slowed anyone down.
How did you get the gig to do the original nutrition label? Did they just like pick you out of a phone book?
Well, it's practically like that. It actually all starts with a woman.
Yeah, I'm not even going there.
Well, I just met a gal who was to become my wife, Donna Greenfield. Still is, by the way.
All right, good.
She was a lawyer at the Federal Trade Commission, and a staffer was walking down the hall and asked her if she knew a good graphic designer. She said, well, I just met this designer named Berkey Belzer, but I have no idea if he's any good or not. So clearly I made a huge impression on her.
Well, she married you, man. Come on.
She married me, yeah. But they had been working with a very well-known New York design firm on the design of the Energy Guide.
Yeah.
Already spent $250,000 getting nowhere. So when I took a look at it, it seemed obvious what was wrong. They hired me. I started from scratch. $10,000 later, the label was done.
That Energy Star thing, by the way, did you pick that color yellow?
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Did you really? Was that you?
Yeah, but you know why?
Oh, man.
Yellow and black are the most visible color combination. There is the most visible color combination you can have. So it was a smart choice.
When you, not just with this one, but with the Energy Star guide that you also did and some other information designs you've done, what are you thinking about when you're trying to get information across concisely, compactly, and informatively?
Well, the goal is, to be clear, it's information design. It's different than regular design.
Yeah.
Really, what it wants you to do is focus on the efficient presentation of information first. And while I always, and any designer, hopes that they're going to have an artistic presentation, artistry plays second fiddle to getting the idea across.
Does that kill you a little bit, that artistry plays second fiddle?
Yeah, it's tough. It means that you need to think differently, and maybe it requires a level of abstract, maybe hierarchical thinking, and totally obsessive personality.
Yeah, you kind of have to be, right?
Yeah, you do. I mean, my shirts are arranged by color in my closet.
Are they really arranged by color in your closet?
Yeah.
Wow. The things you learn in a
radio. Aren't yours?
No, mine are on a dirty pile on a heap on the floor, but that's a whole different thing. Well, Mr. Belzer, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I'm so happy I could join you. Thank you, Kai.
Berkey Belzer, designer of the original nutrition label and a bunch of other stuff as well. He's got his own proposal, by the way, for the nutrition label redesign. You can find it and the original at our website. It's marketplace.org. A consumer economy works only when the delicate balance of supply and demand is in balance. Too much of one or too much of another, and the whole thing goes kerflooey. And figuring out that proper balance is actually a science, which gets us to our regular segment, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blame.
Our listener question today is from Blake Waller of Denmark, South Carolina.
I have always wondered what stores like Walmart, Kmart, all the big boxes do with items that don't sell.
All right, there you go. That's the question. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
It was 2008, and James Merwin had a problem. Actually, he had thousands of problems.
You know, it was probably close to 30,000-40,000 toilets.
Merwin was working for a bathroom fixture company at the time, and this was when the housing bubble had just burst. So people stopped building houses, and they stopped buying toilets to put in them.
You know, in short, you go very quickly to almost bursting at the seams with product everywhere, and we were paying a premium to have store it somewhere else because we didn't have space for it ourselves.
This is something that happens, maybe not as bad, to almost any retailer, from a pharmacy right on up to a big box store. It's called the bullwhip effect. You ramp up to meet what you think demand is going to be, and then demand falls off. But the first thing you can do about it is pretty simple.
The first lever you have is price, right? You know, take 10% off, 20% off. You know, each month, it's the pile slowly went down.
Sometimes things don't go down, though. I am so sorry, I couldn't help myself. Mark Barrett teaches operations and supply chain management at Marquette University.
It could be sold to one of the various discount stores like, you know, TJ Maxx, Marshalls, Ross.
Or you can have your merchandise...
destroyed.
You know, shredded, incinerated, thrown out. Why do they do that again?
The primary concern is the impact on the brand, because suddenly it's, hang on a minute, we've spent all this time and money creating this image that we're an upscale retailer, and now suddenly you can buy our products for 20% of the price if you're just prepared to wait long enough and go to a different outlet store.
Dollar store shame. But what about just donating it?
The trouble is, if you're not careful, what you donate might end up on a Manhattan sidewalk sale competing with you in front of your own store. Sir, what are you selling here?
We are selling ties for $5. Good quality. I think they're like Marco Jacob.
That's Joe Thomas of the corner of 43rd and Lex. But plenty of companies do donate, of course. Walgreens, for example, gives away about 5 million pounds of food a year to charity.
Can I get back to the seven, please?
Reuben Sloan runs supply chain at Walgreens, like the one here at Astor Place in Manhattan, and he says really the best way to deal with unsold merchandise is to not have much of it in the first place.
What we're really trying to do is predict human behavior.
Walgreens sells 18,000 different things at 8,200 different stores. So here we have a protein shake, and here is some Gas-X, which means they have to make 160 million predictions about how much merchandise to order and put out every week. Obviously, they use computers.
Everything that we do is based on a forecast, and that forecast is based on history.
For example, this cough syrup.
We use everything from weather reports to incidents of flu across the country.
They start predicting a year ahead of time.
So for example, if there's a spike in aspirin and toothbrushes, that might be an indication that, there's an outbreak.
That sounds crazy complicated.
It is. I describe it as rocket science.
The key is having lots of history and data. Ruben says they've learned some fun tricks about demand this way.
On Christmas Day, we sell more bacon than anyone else in the United States. We even have a bacon report.
New products or fashion lines are what really involve some serious guesswork. But for any supply chain, one wrong move or bit of bad luck, and you can have a stack of 30,000 toilets on your doorstep.
There's as much art as there is science in a lot of this, and it is a rodeo, or I like to call it, it's a bit of a roller coaster.
Merwin did sell all of his toilets, by the way. Only slight discounting, no shredding or crushing required. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
coming up.
It taught me also something that I've carried with me for the rest of my life, is that I don't want to work for a living.
So now he does sports on television, an ESPN commentator on his first job. But first, let's us do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 0.2% today, 34 points, closed at 16,418. Nicely off the lows, I should add. The NASDAQ dipped less than 0.1%, 1.4334 there. The S&P 500 also gave up less than 0.1%, not even a point, finished at 1877. Financials were mixed. Bank of America picked up 0.8%. Wells Fargo added 0.4%. Goldman Sachs gave back 0.4% today. Boeing shares lost 1.3% after hairline cracks were discovered in the wings of some 787 Dreamliners. Facebook shares jumped more than 3% after one big investment bank raised its price target on the social media company. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.77%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. A Senate committee talks about what the U.S. healthcare system can learn from other countries. And on March 11, 1961, Barbie's boyfriend Ken made his debut. Evolutions of Ken include Sun Lovin' Malibu Ken, Dream Date Ken, Totally Hair Ken, and Harley Davidson Ken. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The college fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon turned 158 years old this past weekend. SAE, as it's known, is one of the biggest fraternities in the country, and it's gotten something of a reputation for its intense hazing of pledges. So SAE took the opportunity of starting its 159th year to announce that it's getting rid of its pledge program. At least 10 deaths have been linked to hazing-related activities at SAE since 2006. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the possible dollar-related motivations.
SAE pays one of the highest rates for liability insurance of any fraternity, and it's been hammered by lawsuits, including a $25 million suit brought by the mother of a 19-year-old Cornell student who died of alcohol poisoning. Brandon Weghorst is a spokesman for SAE.
We realize that a lot of people may have a bad perception of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, which we regret because we know all the good things that our members do every day that don't get attention.
Now students who want to join SAE will simply be invited. It's been a controversial decision, but it's the right move, says Ron Binder, Associate Dean of Students at the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford.
I think they found themselves in a very untenable position of saying it's not sustainable given the number of injuries and deaths and subsequent lawsuits.
Binder's fraternity, Sigma Phi Epsilon, did away with pledging back in the 90s. He says since then, the frat's membership, GPAs, and community service hours have gone up.
I really think that this pledge ban is semantics and public relations.
Andrew Lose pledged SAE at Dartmouth in 2009 and is writing a book called Confessions of an Ivy League Frat Boy.
Before, this organization said they didn't allow hazing and that there was a hazing hotline and all these things, this policy change probably won't accomplish a lot to actually curb the on-the-ground hazing event.
Los doesn't think hazing will really go away until fraternities and sororities do. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The phrase non-governmental organization is almost by definition a broad one. It could be a political advocacy group here, a social services group in China, or almost any group doing almost anything anywhere. And as with any organization, there's a certain amount of bureaucracy in NGO offices. There's office politics and perhaps unintended humor as well. So from Nairobi, Kenya, where there is no shortage of NGOs, comes a new online comedy series called The Samaritans. Hussein Kurji thought it up. He is producing it as well, and he is with us now. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What gave you this idea of NGOs as comedy fodder?
Well, two things. One was I was always looking for something new that had not been done before in terms of entertainment. And I had heard a lot of stories from aid workers in and around Nairobi. And I thought they'd make for good television. So I created a comedy based on those stories.
I wonder if it occurred to you, I'm sure it must have, that you are, in effect, taking on kind of a big machine. I mean, the NGO apparatus, certainly in Kenya, but worldwide, is a big, big deal.
Oh, of course, of course. And, you know, we did it primarily for entertainment. It is a work of fiction, but we weren't naive we knew that there would be conversations around the topic. And the conversation that we're having is nothing new. It's been spoken about for many, many years. I just think that the format that we chose, comedy and exaggerating the tales, have really hit the point. And so far, so good.
You know how sometimes you poke fun at things because you kind of love them? How do you feel about NGOs?
I think there are some who do excellent work. I have a friend who is a PhD who goes out into the field. He doesn't make a big salary. He doesn't have a fancy job title, but he works with stakeholders, and he does an amazing job every single day. I couldn't do that, and I applaud him. And there are many, many people like that around the world. You know, when we had a terrorist attack here in September, the Red Cross were the first ones on site, and that was amazing. But, you know, we decided to show the funnier side and the crazier side of NGO culture.
It's a little bit a mix of The Office, I think, and what I imagine NGOs must be like. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of inspiration from a lot of, you know, mockumentaries that have been done overseas. So you have The Office, the UK Office, US Office. You have Parks and Recreation. So there are many, many inspirations that we drew from.
And then how are you going to distribute this thing? Are you going to do Amazon? Do you try to get a deal with Netflix or Hulu? What are you going to do to get it out there?
We're trying all the above. We're trying to get in touch with Netflix. We're trying to get in touch with Hulu. But, you know, we're a small Kenyan production house, so we have to scream a little louder to get their attention.
What are you going to do if it takes off? I mean, if Netflix calls you and says, we want to distribute this, that I imagine would be both the best and the worst thing that could happen to you.
There's going to be a lot of pressure, but we're very excited. We're ready to go, basically. I mean, we've done our homework. We know the field that we're working in. So we're very confident that we can pull it off.
Hussein Kurji is the creator and the producer of what I guess you'd call a mockumentary about NGO life overseas. It's called The Samaritans. We got him in Nairobi, Kenya. Mr. Kurji, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The calendar says it's March, but there are those who believe the month doesn't really begin until the madness does. The NCAA basketball tournament starts next week, which means ESPN's college sports commentator Reese Davis is going to be getting really busy. This past weekend, Davis and crew wrapped up their 10th season of College Game Day. And while he has made the big time now, he sure didn't start out there. So here he is with the latest installment of our series, First Jobs.
My first job was in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, my hometown. I washed trucks for Weyerhaeuser on Saturday mornings. And when you're 13, 14 years old, that sounds like a really, really good idea because you're going to have your own money. For washing trucks on a Saturday morning at Weyerhaeuser, which took, I don't know, 5-6 hours by the time we finished, I think I might have made like 30 or 40 bucks. If the weather was nice, that was great. When the weather was cold, it was awful because you climbed up underneath the trucks and you had to spray that high-powered hose on the truck and then get down in there and scrub all the road grime off of it. And you just hope that the guy driving the truck hadn't gone through fresh tar on the road, because if you did that, you were there forever. I saved money for shoes because I was so poor that, you know, I didn't have any shoes to wear to school. I just usually wore, you know, cardboard boxes or egg cartons or something like that. Sometimes, you know, if it were really cold, I would have to wrap my feet in plastic bags because we couldn't afford shoes. I'm kidding about that. I did save for shoes, though. I saved for the Converse All-Star basketball shoes, the high-top ones that Dr. J advertised at the time. I think it taught me something that I've carried with me for the rest of my life. I don't want to work for a living. I'm being only somewhat facetious there, But I think it was good for me to actually go and have to work like that. And it wasn't the most fun job in the world, but I think it has proven to be at least somewhat beneficial in my experience and learning work ethic, dependability, and all of that type of thing. I almost always just drive through the car wash. I don't remember the last time I even manually washed my car. Maybe I'm traumatized.
Rhys Davis is a commentator for ESPN. You can tell us the stories of your first jobs. You can tweet them to us at MarketplaceAPM, or you can do it the old-fashioned way if you like. Letters at marketplace.org is our email.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which online polls and surveys firmly jump the shark. The social media team at WFAE out of Charlotte, North Carolina, has come up with a new one, a new poll. It has. Which public radio host are you? It wants to know. It's got some reasonably relevant questions. Who would you most like to interview? What is your favorite public radio show? What should your college major have been? You know, all of those. So anyway, I took it. I'm going to take a minute here to compose myself before I tell you that apparently the internet thinks I ought to be Audie Cornish, and I don't even know what to do with that. How am I not myself, right? All right, we got to go. That is Marketplace from APM. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bider and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I am not Audie Cornish. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.